Okay, well, thanks. It's always nice to be back, even for a couple of days. And, well, I'm doing something a little different than the work I was doing when I was here as a student. I moved into phenomenology sort of almost accidentally the last year and a half. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the modeling that I've been doing. This talk's based on a recent paper with Jim Klein and his grad student, Fang Chen, at McGill. So today, just going to review very quickly some of the basic ideas of wimpy dark matter and where we're possibly detecting it already, possibly. And then talk about, well, the particular detections that I'm interested in trying to understand or to model. Talk about the basic ideas behind the type of model that I'll be presenting. And then move into sort of the cosmological history that's required for these types of models to work, in particular, where there's a multiplet of states of dark matter. And then I'll talk about how, after that's set up, how you get the direct and indirect signals to match with the experiments and observations that have been made so far. And if there's time, I'll get into some possibilities for future searches or extra constraints, both from astrophysics and experiment, on this type of dark matter model. So to start, just remember that there's evidence at really pretty much every distance scale we can see astrophysically for there to be much more matter than just the baryonic matter that, you know, we know and love. And there actually may have been hints that we finally directly detected what this mysterious invisible dark matter is, maybe directly in some experiments on Earth, and perhaps also indirectly in astrophysical measurements. So I'll come back to that in a moment. First, just to remind you, I guess, that I'll be working with the idea that dark matter is some new particle, weakly interacting and massive, so some type of new particle from the GeV to TeV scale. I'll be looking at more of the GeV end. We know it's neutral and colorless because it doesn't interact with the standard model stuff very much. And of course, it's stable over cosmological times because we can still see gravitational evidence for it here in the Milky Way. For structure formation to work properly, or, well, even to get, say, a halo that's expanded much bigger than our galaxy, at this time, the self-interactions of the dark matter must be weak. And that's also consistent with having enough of it. And finally, we know, again, from a variety of evidence that there's 5 to 6 times as much of this dark matter as normal matter. So trying to understand what dark matter is really asking, well, what's about, you know, of the matter in the universe, what's really most of that matter? Here's just sort of, I don't know, maybe a motivational picture, I guess, that's been put together from a lot of different observations. The light dots, of course, are galaxies. This is a cluster of galaxies. And in a way, this picture is evidence for the existence of dark matter by itself, because the blue fuzz is an indication of where mass is as determined by gravitational lensing measurements. So you can see most of the galaxies are, of course, in the center of the cluster, and so is a bit of the mass, but there's also a fair amount of mass in a ring around the outside. And so this is just one particular example, but there are many, where using gravitational lensing, we can look at where the mass is and find that it's not the same place as the galaxies or the hot gas in clusters of galaxies. So moving on, of course, since we've known about dark matter for about 70 years, looking at rotation curves of galaxies, people have been interested in trying to detect it. It should be a decent density of it in the solar neighborhood. Actually, if it's a TeV dark matter particle, for example, there should be about one in a jumbo Coke liter bottle, even here on Earth. But direct detection as of the last year or two is what I call a slightly muddled story. Here's the basic idea. We're going to set up a bunch of, you know, very pure stuff to beat down radioactive backgrounds and search for collisions of dark matter particles with nuclei in the target. So, for example, this is the cryogenic dark matter search, CDMS. I found this picture a year or so ago. But there are some detectors in CDMS's case, germanium and silicon, inside this isolated apparatus. And that's all down in an old mine in Minnesota, the Sudan mine. The point is, these are highly sensitive and tricky experiments. You expect very few interactions with dark matter and nuclei, so you have to really try to control your backgrounds and understand any systematics that you have. So maybe it's not entirely confusing that the different experiments don't all agree with each other, and I'll explain that right now. There are a number of experiments that give null results or constraints on the properties of dark matter. So one, for example, is this CDMS experiment, which, as I said, uses sort of hockey puck type amounts of germanium and silicon as detectors. They had, well, Joe and I were talking about it at lunch, a couple of simultaneous broadcast seminars this past December, which they announced they had maybe two candidate dark matter events at 23% certainty or something like that. The least definitive experimental result announced in that way. But let's not worry about those candidate events. The main point of CDMS is they say essentially, well, on this dotted line, anything above this dotted line here in mass and cross-section per nucleon space is sort of ruled out by the CDMS experiment. Xenon is another experiment that, in this case, looks for collisions off xenon nuclei. It's recently had some preliminary results from a, I guess it's a 100-kilo apparatus or amount of xenon. And they've announced this sort of solid line, sort of a similar constraint to CDMS. Again, everything above that is supposed to be ruled out. However, there are a couple of experiments that have claimed possible detection. So DAMA, the dark matter search, is a sodium iodide doped with thallium detector in the Gran Sasso mine in Italy that's got an annual modulation signal. Since the dark matter has sort of a direction of motion through the galaxy, as the Earth moves one way in its orbit or the other way in orbit, you get a different flux of dark matter into the detector, and DAMA is the only experiment that's set up to determine the modulation on an annual basis, and they claim there's a signal that's modulated with essentially the right phase and a yearly period. They claim that about 8 years or so. Cogent is another experiment, also germanium detector, but with a different way to detect the collision events, that's also located in the Sudan mine, essentially right next to CDMS. They've also claimed recently a lot of candidate dark matter events. Maybe some people would argue whether these are background events or dark matter, but that's another possible detection. The real issue to try to resolve these is how sensitive these experiments are to low recoil energies of the target nucleus. Because all the, well, at least Cogent, where they can tell you what the recoil energy is, all the events they're seeing are sort of down at the low range. And you can see that the constraints from xenon and CDMS get worse at the light mass dark matter particles, where you'd expect to get low recoil energy events. So that's where precisely CDMS and xenon are losing their sensitivity. And in fact, these green region here is where Cogent says that the dark matter mass and cross-section of the nuclei should be. And the red and blue regions are where DAMA says it should be, with different assumptions about how the detector operates, which I'll explain in a moment. So, well, you know, maybe there's a way around it. So the proposal that I'm going to follow that has been made is that maybe dark matter has a mass that's GeV scale or few GeVs, which will lead to a low recoil energy, which, well, consistent sort of with DAMA and Cogent, and may help get around some of these constraints from the other experiments.
What are the circles in the middle?
Here? I think that's another range that's consistent with DAMA, so sort of disconnected from the.
Or it's when they didn't turn on the channeling effect.
Yeah, well, so the red is without channeling and the blue is with, and I think it's just some details in the experiment that they're not so sensitive in some places. And I believe the black area is, you know, somebody's prediction for a constrained MSSM. However, there's another place that we might have been observing dark matter for about 40 years and not known it. And that is in astrophysics. If you look at the center of the galaxy with, you know, the right frequency eyes, you can see a spectral line that's fairly sharp at 511 keV. So here's a sort of the best fit to the shape of this from the Integral SBI satellite. That's the galactic center, latitude, longitude. And you can see that the galactic bulge is several times as bright as that of the disk. And the best fit, at least to the bulge component of this radiation, is approximately axisymmetric. The resolution on Integral and the other experiments is not good enough to determine how axisymmetric it is. And so again, that's sort of a matter that people argue about a little bit. But if you accept it's axisymmetric, that causes some difficulties for a lot of astrophysical explanations, because most of the sources are not distributed in an axisymmetric way. The line is also pretty sharp. You can see here energy and count per energy bin. This is really, it's mostly a narrow line with a little bit of a Doppler broadened line. And there's also a component from the spin flipped orthopositronium annihilation. So you can see that what's happening here really is that it's really coming from electron positron annihilation through the formation of a positronium bound state. So it's really, you know, pretty much at rest. These are non-relativistic, E plus E minus, at least by the time that they're annihilating. So the dark matter proposal, and that I want to make today, is that there's some excited state of dark matter that's sitting a little bit more than an MeV above the ground state of dark matter. And when this excited state of dark matter decays, there's a small coupling to the standard model, and the only thing it can do is produce an electron-positron pair. And where this excited state could come from, well, it could be from some metastable population that's been hanging around since the beginning of the universe, or it could be dark matter particles in the galaxy colliding and exciting to this unstable state and then decaying again. And again, more details later. So just lay out now for the basic structure of the dark matter model we'll talk about today. And what I'm going to do is assume that these signals that I've talked about are all really from dark matter. So the cogent signal, the Dhamma signal, and this 511 keV line from Integral. So I'll start out talking about, well, how can we reconcile various experiments? Again, the more details of how to produce this 511 keV line from the center of the galaxy, and then give you a specific model of dark matter, a specific dark sector with an SU2 gauge symmetry. So just as a preview for what is going to be required, okay, to get the experimental work, experiments to line up with each other, you saw on the exclusion plot that cogent and Dhamma both favored sort of a light dark matter mass. So I'm looking at dark matter masses on the scale of a few GeVs. You can have several nearly degenerate states. So for example, there could be an endothermic model where there's some dark matter ground state, a metastable population of dark matter, a little bit more than two electron masses above, and then a third state that's a few keVs above that. And there are two couplings between the standard model and the dark matter sector. So there's one where you can collide with a nucleus and scatter up to this top state. Or there's also one where once you've gotten to this top state in the galaxy, that can decay, again, releasing electron and positron to the ground state. So that's the endothermic type model. There's also an exothermic one where it's the top state that's metastable, and the intermediate state is the unstable one. And again, both of these are going to be consistent with both experiments and the 511 KeV signal. So, and they both have two weak couplings to the standard model. And the third one should be either extremely tiny, so whatever third transition I'm not showing, that coupling to the standard model should either be tiny or vanishing, at least at tree level. And the key to this is really the symmetry breaking of this non-abelian SU2 dark gauge group. Okay. So how this works with the various experiments to get them together is to remember I said it's the recoil energy or sensitivity to low recoil energy that was an important distinction between the experiments. And again, here's the same exclusion plot. CDMS and xenon, the two that give the big constraints, are not as sensitive to small recoil energies. So for example, CDMS, as I mentioned, it's got two different types of detectors, the germanium detectors and silicon detectors. And silicon, being a lighter nucleus, is more sensitive to recoils from light dark matter particles. Unfortunately, it's harder to calibrate the silicon detectors. So there's some uncertainties in the calibration that might mean that this exclusion line, in this region at least, is maybe a little optimistic. And a CDMS person might tell you that they're really confident about this, but it's arguable. Xenon also has some uncertainties in detection in this low mass range. That's because their standard analysis requires two different signals in order to call in event a dark matter collision. They require both a scintillation from, electrons dislodged due to the nuclear recoil, and then also an ionization signal picked up later in the detector. Again, these low recoil events don't create much of a scintillation signal, so it's possible that xenon has been vetoing real dark matter events because they don't have both of the expected signals. Let me just remind you quickly, how is that light dark matter then is related to the small recoil energy? If you look at sort of a dark matter particle coming in with a given velocity v, the maximum recoil energy, if you just smack head on the nucleus, is, it's proportional to the velocity squared, or the kinetic energy in the system. So mu n is the reduced mass of the dark matter nucleus system. But it's also inversely proportional to the mass of the nucleus. So a heavier nucleus will have an even lower energy, and that's why, for example, that the silicon is more sensitive to the light dark matter than the germanium is in CDMS, for example. But furthermore, given a dark matter mass, there's sort of a maximum recoil energy any dark matter particle is going to have, because dark matter has essentially a typical velocity in the halo in our galaxy. And in fact, there's even a maximum above which the dark matter would have escaped from the Milky Way. So the key point is we want the light dark matter to give us a small recoil energy to evade the constraints possibly and get us in this range. But I do just want to caution that a lot of these statements are still up for debate, and there are rumors of conference presentations that still haven't been published that are saying, well, xenon's better than we thought, and so on. So still up in the air, but at the moment, this is roughly where the published information is. So we still need to get Dhamma and Cogent to agree with each other, because you saw they weren't quite overlapping. And there are two different ways to handle that. One, in the model that I'm talking about, it's always going to be scattering between the two top states of that dark matter triplet. So the ones that are separated by just a few KeVs from each other.
And yet there were two ways for them to analyze their data, and Cogent was right in the middle. So why
aren't
they consistent? I mean,
why aren't they consistent?
What if Dhamma sort of was used to mean? Why can't Dhamma be in the
middle? Well, that's actually one possibility in a sense. So those constraints I gave you were assuming that the scattering is elastic. off of the nucleus. And in a non-abelian model like this, the couplings between the dark matter and the standard model are always off diagonal. So it's always an inelastic scattering. In this endothermic model where you're actually upscattering, that mass difference is small enough to be unimportant. So it's essentially an elastic scattering. And so what some authors have said is, well, okay, let's look at these measurement uncertainties in Dhamma and Kujin. In particular, one that's important is an idea of channeling, which case, well, normally there's some quenching effect. You have a less than optimal efficiency in gathering all the energy and measuring the recoil energy of a given event. In some cases, however, though, since the detectors are crystals, if the nucleus goes in the right direction, you get a boosted or enhanced efficiency in the recoil energy measurement. And those two different circles or target regions for Dhamma were assuming different amounts of channeling. And so if you play with those assumptions and it's not entirely clear how much channeling there is, then that's one way to get those regions to line up. So there have been many authors who studied this. There's a recent paper by Dan Hooper and collaborators, and they say that, well, okay, if you look at sort of the error bars on the amount of quenching and channeling, then there's pretty decent agreement if you have a dark matter candidate near 7 GeVs. And again, I'm just going to say, since the kinetic energy they have is bigger, the dark matter particles would have is a little bigger than this 5 keV splitting, it's okay to consider this endothermic model as being essentially elastic scattering. Probably use a little bit of reanalysis to really nail down the details. But when people have talked about inelastic sort of upscattering events really making a difference, they're talking about a 20 GeV kind of, keV kind of scale. On the other hand, there have been a couple of groups, Graham and collaborators and Essig and collaborators, who've talked about this exothermic scattering. And the idea here is that, well, when you downscatter, that releases energy, and that basically all goes into the nucleus. And so what that does is that for the very low energy events, that boosts the recoil energy by a little bit. So if you have actually zero velocity dark matter coming in, there's still a floor. There's a minimum amount of recoil energy that you get. So if you're going to look at recoil spectrum, rates per day per kilogram, off different nuclei, there's, well, for the light nuclei, there's a peak a bit farther out, and then there are sort of sharp peaks. Again, that's sort of collecting all the very low energy events and piling them up at this minimum recoil energy. What this says is, well, we can actually reduce the mass of the dark matter particle more, because out in the tail, this inelasticity or this release of energy becomes unimportant. And so there are more events at low recoil energy than you would expect looking out at the tail, given a dark matter, a specific dark matter mass. So you get rid of the higher recoil energy events very quickly if you have, at a given dark matter mass, if you have some exothermic scattering process. So here you'd be looking at, say, 3 to 5 GeV dark matter candidate. And they argue that if you have a few percent of the dark matter events channeled in the germanium crystal at Kojin, then you get a good agreement between Dhamma and Kojin. So again, it's more assumptions about subtleties of the experiment. Any questions about this so far? Okay. So then the other trick we have to do is get the dark matter to produce this 511 keV line from the center of the galaxy, and there are going to be a couple of ways to do that. But both of them involve this essential idea that there's an unstable state or some state of dark matter which can decay to the ground state and do some small coupling with the standard model, produce electrons and positrons. So one we've been thinking about the longest is an idea that the dark matter gets collisionally excited into a state that's unstable to decay. Again, look at those two top dark matter states. You start within the galaxy some population of metastable dark matter states here moving towards each other, and they can collide and up or down scatter into the unstable excited state of dark matter. And as those move along after some period of time, they're going to decay and release these electrons. And we can just work out the rate of the positron production, which should be, you know, mapped to the intensity of this 511 keV signal directly. The key things to note about this is, well, okay, first of all, it's proportional to the scattering cross section, but it's also proportional to the square of the dark matter number density. Just because it's a collision process, you need to pick out two dark matter particles. And also the square of whatever the relic abundance of the metastable state is. So why the abundance of any particle is just the number density divided by the entropy density in the universe, this is something that is constant. Just as the universe expands, there's nothing else going on. And this ratio here is, well, okay, it's the abundance of the metastable state versus the total abundance of dark matter. So you're saying, what fraction of the dark matter is in this metastable state? And that's going to reduce the rate by the square. However, there's another possibility. One is just that this unstable dark matter state is also, in a sense, metastable and could be hanging around a little bit longer than the age of the universe. So that requires some very weak coupling to the standard model, and I'll tell you how weak in a little bit. But then the rate for positron production just goes like 1 power of the number density, 1 power of the fraction of dark matter in this state, and then, of course, 1 over the lifetime. So I can now get into the actual particle physics of the talk. So let me just start with telling you the field content of the model. The dark matter itself is going to be a triplet of Majorana fermions with a mass, well, as I said, in the few GeV range. So in the endothermic case, about 7. In the exothermic case, about, well, between 3 to 5. And it's at a triplet of some SU2 gauge group. Now, if there's a gauge force, there needs to be a set of SU2 gauge bosons to go with it. I'll label those B. So that's a dark sector. It's not the electroweak one, of course. And finally, we're going to need to break the symmetry, so we need a set of dark Higgs bosons. So delta, each delta A is some SU2 triplet Higgs. It could be, well, there can be up to 3 of them. And just for purposes of arranging the numerology, I guess, we also want to have an SU2 quintuplet Higgs. It's possible that there are other, you know, ways to arrange the Higgs sector to do what you want, get the right mass splittings and everything, but this is sort of an easy one to find. So there is a possibility. Now, the Higgs expectation values, since the symmetry is broken, well, we find that the triplet Higgs, you need to imagine that these are all orthogonal to each other. And in that case, the ith Higgs triplet has its VEV aligned along the ith direction in the SU2 gauge group. So delta 1's VEV is all along the one axis of the SU2 and so on. And these are all in the 10 to 30 GeV, you say. Sigma, this quintuplet, and, well, you can organize it by either a potential or some gauge rotations to the diagonal. And let's parameterize the diagonal elements in terms of two numbers, A and B. And remember, the quintuplet is symmetric and traceless, and so that's why the trace of that adds to 0. Again, just for convenience in the numerology, it's good to imagine some VEV where this expectation value A is -3 times expectation value B. Again, if that's not quite right, it's no disaster. It just requires some tweaking.
So what's the SU2 gauge coupling? Is similar to the other SU2 gauge coupling?
The strength?
Yeah.
I'll come back to that later, but it's weaker.
Why did you choose that particular Higgs thing? I mean, why did you go to a single triplet?
Well, a single triplet is not going to break the gauge group completely, for one thing. But you'll see in the next slide or so why. The size of this for sigma is going to depend on various couplings, in particular you call a coupling to the dark matter particles. I should also say you should be able to do the same thing with, say, scalar dark matter or whatever you want. But again, it's nice just to have one concrete model that works out fairly simply. Okay. Let me just comment briefly as an aside on the naturalness of this type of setup, and particularly the VEVs. Well, the triplet VEVs, I will say, you might expect them to be boosted up to, say, the supersymmetry breaking scale or something like that. But if the only coupling to more massive states, for example, is through the standard model, then this actually agrees with sort of a one-loop calculation if you assume that that's where the biggest part of the mass in the VEV comes from. And also, it may be unnatural to take some relationship between these two components of sigma to be so close to each other, or for A to be close to minus 3B. But there is actually a simple potential you can write down that immediately gives you that, just based on the trace and the determinant of this matrix. So, I don't know. Does that mean anything? Maybe not. But at least you can write down something that's gauge invariant and simple to do this. But for now, let's just take this as a proof of principle and maybe worry about the naturalness if we want to get around to embedding this in a supersymmetric version of some type. Okay. All right, moving on. With the symmetry broken, the gauge bosons get massive, and their masses are going to be in the 100 MeV to GeV range once we find out what this gauge coupling G is. The key thing to notice about having all these various formulas for the gauge boson masses is that they're different. So for one point, and just to answer your question, you can see if you just had, say, one triplet and none of the other Higgs, the first gauge boson is going to be massless. So. But the key point is that, they're all different from each other. In particular, mu2 and mu3 are sort of offset by the quintuplet expectation because this piece vanishes with A equal to minus 3. Now, the fact that we have symmetry breaking also splits the dark matter masses, and an analogy you can make is splitting of the hydrogen P wave states in the presence of a magnetic field that breaks the rotational symmetry. One effect that comes with the symmetry breaking that splits the masses, if there's a Yukawa coupling between the quintuplet and the dark matter, that gives a mass splitting that's of order 2 times the Yukawa coupling Y times the expectation value B. And that splitting is roughly the same for both of the two top states. So here, delta M13 is the mass gap between the bottom state 1 and the top state 3. And that's about the same as delta M12, the splitting between the two bottom states. And so that should be a little bit more than an MeV to give us the electron-positron production. But there are also radiative corrections just from the simple propagator correction. So here are the gauge labels. We have dark matter state A coming in. They have some loop with a different dark matter state in the middle and some third gauge boson state in the loop. Because the different gauge bosons have different masses, those loops contribute differently. So that creates a smaller mass splitting, between all the different states, but in particular between the top two states. So we get some delta M23. And since the gauge boson masses are, say, the 100 MeV range, we're going to see that the gauge coupling gives a fine structure constant of 10^-4, 10^-5, 10^-4, well, really 10^-5 range, then we can easily and naturally get a splitting of just a few keV's. And furthermore, since we're just taking some convention such that the third dark matter state, chi3, is more is heavier than the second state, that tells us just that the delta 2 Higgs expectation value needs to be bigger than the expectation value from delta 3, and in particular that it's non-zero. So in the endothermic model, we can actually turn delta 3 off, and that decouples the second state, or the metastable state, from the first state. But you can't do that in the exothermic model. We'll see why in a second. The reason is that the couplings to the standard model are through the delta triplet Higgs's getting some expectation value. So imagine you've got some massive particle that's charged both in the dark SU2 group and under standard model hypercharge. Then if it's got, say, a Yukawa interaction with the delta, then integrating that out gives you this dimension 5 operator. And this is sort of the most, well, general gauge invariant thing you can write down at dimension 5. So there's some scale due to the massive particle, lambda I, that can be, in principle, different for each of the Higgs multiplets delta I. So what you find is that the ith component, or the ith dark gauge boson, gains some coupling, really, to the electric current. And this coupling to the standard model electric current is of order delta over lambda, which we'll call epsilon. Now, there are other, as you sort of integrate below this scale, you'll find that this induces other dark matter standard model interactions, including mixing between the two different Higgs sectors. But that's through loops, and we're going to assume that's subdominant. So this should be the main channel. Okay. So coming back to this, if, say, one of the triplets has a zero expectation value or just isn't in the model, say delta 3, then there's no coupling for at tree level for, say, the third gauge boson. And that can make, again, say, in the endothermic case, that second state stable at tree level. So the first thing we need to check to see if this is working is that you know that the metastable state is long-lived to still be hanging around in the universe today. So in the exothermic model, the metastable state is supposed to be chi3. And we know that delta 2 has to be non-zero. So there has to be some potential mixing to the standard model for the direct decay of the top metastable state to the ground state by releasing electron-positron pairs. And it's proportional to, the lifetime, or rate, sorry, is proportional to the epsilon 2 parameter. In fact, it's here. You can work out the exact three-body decay phase space in the non-relativistic limit. Get this result. And what you find is if you want this to be long-lived compared to the universe, your coupling epsilon 2 needs to be less than about 10^-9. So this is a small number, and it means that one of the lambdas has to be at about 10^10 GeV. So large, but not even gut scale. In the endothermic model, as you said, we can set the third Higgs VEP to zero, or just drop that third triplet Higgs from the model. In that case, at tree level, the metastable state 2 is stable, but there's no symmetry protecting it from decaying, so you have to consider loops. And so you can, for example, get a loop where the 1 and 2 dark gauge bosons have this suppressed coupling to the electric current, the electrons. And then through a non-abelian gauge interaction, they can couple to this transition. But it turns out that sort of the leading effect, or the divergent part of this loop, vanishes between the two different Feynman diagrams. So that doesn't generate a direct coupling to the electric current. You might think this would give you a magnetic moment type coupling at the sort of the first finite contribution, but that also cancels out. So you get some very suppressed coupling and extremely long lifetime, 10 to the 33 seconds, even if you have the largest sort of acceptable mixings for the other two gauge bosons to the standard model. Why it's so suppressed, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm getting a little confused. You're assuming most of the dark matter is in this metastable state?
Well, it's not going to be most of it, but a significant fraction of it.
So why is, why wouldn't there be a lot of dark matter in the ground state?
Well, there will be. Actually, I'll tell you why more specifically it's that number in a couple, about three slides. Right now, this is just to say, in principle, it could live this long. It's a little weird. We looked for a lot of diagrams to try to figure out how to, ways this might decay, and this is the fastest we could find, and it's weird. There's no symmetry protecting it, but it seems to be suppressed at least in a couple loops. Okay. Well, to get to Gary's question, when you talk about the history cosmologically of this dark matter multiplet, in particular, where does the dark matter density come from? That's sort of a usual story, but how do we also find the residual populations of these three different states? Well, the usual story for WIMP dark matter is that there's some thermal freeze-out process and a relic abundance left over after the annihilation stopped being efficient. But also there's scattering between the different states of the dark matter that happens even after the dark matter is done annihilating. So we have to ask, when does that freeze out to tell us what fraction of the dark matter is left in the metastable state? And the key, of course, is always going to be the efficiency of interactions. And here's sort of the standard picture for the annihilation. We have the log of the abundance plotted here versus, essentially 1 over the temperature in mass units. See, as it stays in thermal equilibrium, if the interaction is fast, the abundance drops off because of the usual Boltzmann suppression. But then at some point, the interactions are inefficient. It falls out of equilibrium and freezes to some abundance, and that's just the key physics for both of these calculations. Let me just remind you quickly of how the annihilation works. So the early universe, of course, was some hot particle soup, and there's high densities. So the dark matter can be created and destroyed like everything else. But then as the universe cools down because of expansion, the numbers decrease. And eventually, the dark matter becomes too dilute to find each other. Essentially, the mean free path gets larger than the Hubble scale. And since the dark matter is going to be stable over the age of the universe, there's some relic population left over. And the abundance of dark matter ends up being just inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. And so the annihilation cross-section that we need in order to match the observed relic density of dark matter is essentially independent of the mass of dark matter over the GeV/dt. There's a log running, but we can more or less ignore that. So to do the calculation, we need to work out what's the annihilation cross-section, both to the gauge bosons and to any of the Higgs bosons that are lighter than the dark matter. So let's just assume that the Yukawa couplings are negligible compared to the gauge coupling, and that's consistent with the mass splittings that we've been talking about. In that case, you can just work out the annihilation cross-section. There's the STU diagrams to the gauge bosons, an S-channel diagram for annihilation to the Higgses. And due to the fact that it's a non-abelian gauge group, if you want to avoid mucking around with the polarization vectors, you can just subtract off the amplitude squared for ghost production. In any case, so this is for massless gauge bosons and Higgs states. N3 is the number of triplet Higgs that are light compared to the dark matter, and N5 is the light quintuplets, the number of them. Now, the masses do change. So if we give masses after breaking symmetry, that does change the matrix elements a bit. but not very much. The leading effect is really just through the kinematics, and so we can replace the massless cross-section by the cross-section times some kinematic suppression factor, where mu bar is sort of the average mass of the annihilation product states. Furthermore, this annihilation cross-section we want isn't the usual one where you just have a single dark matter state in the standard model, because now we have other states that are lighter than the dark matter that can contribute to the entropy of the universe. And so that's another sort of wrinkle in the calculation to take into account. But in the end, we find that this dark fine structure constant, alpha g, is of order 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 4 once you factor in the dark matter mass. So it's proportional to the mass of the dark matter. Now, here we come, how much of the dark matter is each state? Well, okay, you use scattering processes, say, between the top two states that downscatter into the ground state. And so the ratio of the abundances will decrease as the temperature falls below the mass splitting. And we know, again, this positron production rate is either directly proportional or proportional to the square of this abundance. So what we need to do is look at when this type of scattering freezes out. The cross-section, parentheses is missing. The cross-section we can calculate analytically, a tree-level calculation is valid in this parameter range. And so we can just solve a Boltzmann equation with the tree-level cross-section for this downscattering. And we can find the abundance of the dark matter, again, across parameter space. We find if the gauge boson mass mu that mediates this scattering is large, that sort of saturates the abundance so that essentially the dark matter is one-third in each of the states at the time of this freeze-out. If the unstable state decays fast enough, then it can just decay to the ground state. So you'll have two-thirds in the ground state and one-third in the metastable state. It's not always that ideal. Here are some plots for both the endothermic type case, the higher masses, and the exothermic case. So what this here is, these contours are plots of the log of the abundance of the metastable state versus the total dark matter. Here for varying gauge boson masses, and here for varying mass splittings between the top two states. And you can see at high enough gauge boson masses, they saturate. But so we can take this into account and work it out. The other thing, just as an aside, it's another technicality dealing with that freeze-out calculation, is you have to look at the actual temperature of the non-relativistic dark matter, because if it's not coupled to the standard model, that temperature redshifts faster than the temperature of the relativistic stuff. That's just because, the kinetic energy the momentum redshifts like 1 over the scale factor, but then the kinetic energy, or the temperature, kinetic temperature, will then redshift like the square of that. That's faster than a photon redshifting. So we then need to check how well can the dark matter be heated up by colliding off of electrons in the early universe. So we can look at that. And decoupling at some temperature that's larger than where that scattering, dark matter scattering, freeze out occurs, suppresses the abundance a little bit by this square root factor. But as it turns out, the decoupling from the standard model is really controlled by whichever mixing with the standard model is largest. And you can work out the scaling of the scattering rate, and here's the decoupling temperature for various mass gaps. And we've already folded that into the previous results. So how does it all work out? Let me tell you the signals. There are a few different models, the decaying dark matter, and then the endothermic and exothermic case. Let me just say that all this requires some assumptions about dark matter halos. This is a simulated halo by the Virgo Consortium. All the dots are little clumpy subhalos. But as you'd expect, the results that we have are sensitive to the distribution of the dark matter throughout the galaxy. And, we don't know a whole lot observationally about how dark matter is spread through the galaxies. in particular at the centers of galaxies, that's really an inconclusive statement right now. There's not anything really nailed down observationally. Simulations suggest that the dark matter density is sort of cuspy near the center of the galaxies, meaning it sort of becomes infinite near the center. But there have been very few simulations that include the effect of baryonic matter, which is actually the main mass in the center of a galaxy. And it's unclear whether that makes them less cuspy or even more cuspy. And well, the sort of the newest simulations that we found in November say that it actually makes it a little bit cuspy, so or cuspier even than the baryon-free simulations. So that's what we're going to assume, is that the dark matter profile is pretty cuspy, and this is going to be something we call an iNASTO profile, because it's one that lets us dial the cuspiness by means of a free parameter. So let's look at the possibility that the 511 keV line is produced by the decays of some long-lived dark matter unstable state. And can that decay account for the positron production? Well, depending on precisely the cuspiness of the halo, you need a coupling to the standard model in order 10 to the minus 12 or 10 to the minus 11. So this is very small. It does say that the high energy scale in that dimension 5 operator is maybe guttish, so maybe that's appealing or not. We can also work out the angular profile of the 511 keV line just by looking at the line of sight integral of the dark matter density. And so for a variety of different halos of fairly cuspy but not super cuspy, we get a good match. So here's these boxes are essentially the intensity measurements of integral as a function of angular distance from the galactic center. So there's a few different halos that give sort of reasonable fits to that. And the direct detection signal of this decaying dark matter model can be either the endothermic or exothermic case. It doesn't matter. So how do we match the direct detection signal for the endothermic dark matter? Saying, well, this is essentially the same as elastic scattering, so let's match that to the elastic scattering region. What we're looking at here is scattering. Okay, first of all, in the galaxy for the 511 keV line, we need to look at the scattering of the second chi state into the third one. So what's the rate of that? And in this parameter space, again, mass versus small mass splitting, here with some value of the gauge boson mass. This red line is where we get the correct positron production rate for that astrophysical signal. We can match this to the region and parameter space where gamma and cogen are supposed to agree, according to Hooper et al. And so those confident regions are the pink vertical bars here. And we need the cross-section per nucleon to just match up with what they say, given our mass splittings. Well, because our dark matter couples to the standard model only through the electric current, it's only going to couple to protons in the nucleus and not to neutrons as well. Whereas the typical assumption in all the phenomenological papers is equal coupling between protons and neutrons. So we need to rescale by the atomic number versus atomic mass squared, because it's the cross section. And it's going to be the sodium nucleus that's the important one, because that's the light nucleus in the DAMA detector. And that's the one that's sensitive to the light dark matter particles. We also need to scale by the abundance of this second dark matter state, because that's the one that's scattering off of the nuclei. And compare, what our halo assumed density of dark matter for our halo compared to the usual reference value. And we also need to rescale the velocity of the dark matter, because it is slightly endothermic. There's slightly less phase space due to the fact there's some threshold velocity for scattering up the dark matter particle. So we need to account for that. And what we find is that the coupling epsilon 1 between the dark matter and the standard model is about 10 to the minus 5. And that's shown in the blue lines. That's the log of epsilon 1. And then the black lines are the log of the mass mu 1 of the first dark gauge boson. Okay. There's only a very weak dependence on the other mixing parameter, epsilon 2, through the washout effect that I talked about a moment ago. Okay. So again, I just have to rescale the per proton to per nucleon. Here are a couple of the results that we had. We're revising these and talking to a referee a little bit, but the results essentially still the same. The contours here tell you the positron production rate relative to the sort of the fiducial one that you need to explain integral. And so this dark black line is the one that you want. You see there's always some nice overlap with the allowed region. And that's for some, this is for some reference, very cuspy dark matter halo. But you can also get it to work here. It's this sort of teal aqua line that matches. You still get enough positron production even for a less cuspy dark matter halo. It's a similar story in parallel for the exothermic case. Here in the galaxy, we're calculating the downscattering chi3, chi3 to chi2, chi2 to give the positron production rate for the integral signal. And where that matches is shown here on this red line. It's slightly less due to a slightly increased washout in the early universe, and that's due to the masses of the gauge bosons, how they end up. Again, we compare to the elastic limit of scattering off protons, and we have the same type of rescalings due to the abundance, the proton versus neutron and proton, and density over the reference value. What we see here, again, the blue dotted lines are the sort of the log of the epsilon 1 coupling to the standard model. And, you know, it's in the range that's a little bit less than 10 to the minus 3. And the dark gauge boson masses are in sort of the few hundred MeV range. And I will say, in the previous slide, I said there's a weak dependence on the other mixing to this standard model. Okay. Here, it's actually almost completely independent. So these lines here show what you would have for the positron production. The black line, if you had a very large epsilon 2 of a tenth, and the dotted blue lines are for 10 to the minus 10. So you can see there's almost no shift, even over a very large difference. Here are the same type of plots. So again, you can see the blue regions here are where the Dama parameter space fits in, and according to the other authors, Graham et al. And so we see some overlap in all the cases for the very cuspy and the slightly less cuspy halos. The one note, though, is if we are looking at this signal for the exciting dark matter in the center of the galaxy, we can try to figure out, well, where are they colliding? And the angular profile for that is this red dotted line, which is obviously not wide enough to explain by itself the observations. But perhaps the positrons propagate significantly before they can annihilate, and they need to propagate a kiloparsec or two to do that. There are people astrophysically who have argued that that's possible, and in a lot of cases they've argued that that's possible in order to try to say that you don't need a dark matter explanation. So that's one possibility, but another possibility is that the unstable dark matter state, if the appropriate coupling to the standard model is of order 10 to the minus 7, then that dark matter state has about a million year lifetime, and that would give it time to propagate as a dark matter particle about a kiloparsec or so, because it's moving about 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light.
Why is it so strongly peaked at small angles without that effect? I mean, what?
Well, it's essentially because if you compare to the measure in the line of sight integral,
yeah, exactly.
These cuspy halos look pretty much like a delta function. Yeah, but they don't look like a delta function compared to the usual volume measure, mm-hmm. And so the total production rate is, you know, has a P peak sort of further out from the center, but if you're using a line of sight integral, it's really peaked at the center. It's just an integration measure, really. Anyway, since I've got just like a couple minutes, I'll very briefly overview some of the other places to find constraints, both in astrophysics and the lab, but I will say not at this place, which you probably think about. So not in Switzerland. Where can we find these? Well, first of all, if we have this exothermic model, so that the metastable state is the third one, it can decay to the second state by a loop process like this, emitting a single photon. And that's due to the fact that there's a non-abelian term in this kinetic mixing that induces a transition magnetic moment for the dark matter. And, well, epsilon 1 is determined by the direct detection experiments. G, the dark matter coupling, is determined by the thermal abundance calculations. That tells us this lifetime is fixed to 10 to the 19 seconds. That's older than the age of the universe by about a factor of 100. But at energy scales of a few keV, this is a little bit more than twice the observed signal by Chandra. So this is potentially ruled out already. However, at those energy scales, we haven't worked in the absorption, which is also likely to be, you know, a factor of a couple or more. So, Amy, this is a potentially possible observational signal, at least of the exothermic model. There are also decays of the unstable state. So after, say, you collisionally excite, most of the unstable state is going to decay by emitting electron-positron pairs, but some of them, some branching ratio, will decay by a similar diagram. But it turns out that in these models, that branching ratio is too small to observe that. Okay. The CMB also gives some constraints because late dark matter annihilations that occur every so often will thicken the surface of last scattering a bit. And there are a couple other places where the dark matter annihilations might muck things up, but the most robust one is from that last scattering surface. And it turns out if the dark matter annihilation only produced electrons and positrons, we'd probably be just ruled out, but because the gauge bosons we have are massive enough to produce muons and pions as well, we're sort of marginally safe. And also the fact that the correct annihilation cross-section we need for the relic density is reduced due to having extra states lighter than the dark matter. That also sort of shifts us down a little bit on these plots. So we seem to be marginally safe from that. I might skip this, but just to say that some people have suggested that long-lived particles decaying around the time of nucleosynthesis might help resolve the lithium problem in DBN. And the dark Higgs sector may be interesting in these models, but we haven't pursued that in detail. Experimentally, the place you really want to look for this type of dark matter is not so much the LHC, but at a beam dump experiment. So you've got all your electron beams, say, hitting some absorptive target that are really all interacting, you have very high luminosities, and so you can overcome these tiny couplings and produce these B dark matter gauge bosons. And if the decay of that B particle happens quickly enough, you'll get a detector signal of extra charged particles in your detector down the line. So Bjorken and collaborators, and then Essig and collaborators, have also proposed some, well, they've summarized the constraints. They've proposed some new experiments that would be sensitive to the outlined areas in red and blue here. And these dots in red are where our exothermic models would fall, and the blue dots are where the endothermic models would fall. And so except for, you know, one case, at least we've got you know, reasonably in this observable range for the first gauge photon. So that's an interesting possibility. Another place you might think to look is sort of decays of the standard model Z to the dark matter sector, but it turns out that's very weakly limited because the width of the gauge boson is just wide enough that we end up with no new constraint. So I'll just leave you with a quick summary and say that the takeaway message should be that dark matter may be connecting many areas of active research. And I think, well, whether or not any specific model turns out to be true, it's something very interesting to be thinking about right now. And thank you for your time.
Are there lots of competing models?
Well, there are lots of variations, yeah.
Right. They all use this three-state idea of integralizations.
Well, oh, you mean for the integral signal?
Yeah.
Or? Well, so for integral, there are some various astrophysical explanations proposed, of course. So those are decays of radioactive elements produced by supernovae every couple hundred years or so, accretion disks in low-mass X-ray binaries. Those seem to be pretty good for the disk component, but it's hard to get them to fit the bulge very well. People have talked about decaying or annihilating MeV-scale dark matter, but well, you know, if you want a thermal abundance, you need very weak couplings for that. So there are some problems there. This idea of having collisionally excited dark matter goes back to Neil Wiener and Doug Finkbeiner, probably the early part of the decade, last decade. But we sort of developed the three-state model because we realized that you can't. Even for heavy dark matter, TeV scale, the speeds are known well enough that you don't have enough kinetic energy to jump over twice the electron mass. Mm-hmm. And that was something we showed in numerics last fall. And we'd even already sort of previously come up with this three-state model. In terms of connecting this to cogent and Dama, I think we're the only people who've looked at that for sure. But yeah, I mean, in terms of how to reconcile the different direct detection experiments, there's sort of a dime a dozen kind of models right now. I guess whenever Xenon's next results come out, probably narrow things down a little bit.
Is Camilla that dollar needs to be discussed?
Well, I had that and I took it out for length, but Camilla and so Fermi also were measuring sort of these very high energy electrons and positrons, so 10 to almost 1,000 GeV. And so one thing we looked at is can annihilation of dark matter also produce these? And so Jim and I have looked at that. And of course, a lot of people were very excited about that possibility. The last, you know, toward the end of last year, there's sort of good evidence that Fermi sort of ruled out the amount of inverse Compton radiation that you'd expect, so upscattering of photons from these things. There might be some ways around that if, say, subhalos contribute significantly to the Pamela Fermi, sort of the dark matter annihilation. Jim is actually working on that with some other students, but it's unclear whether that would work. And there's actually a paper last week or so that claimed sort of final state Breming of weak gauge bosons would produce antiprotons anyway. But that's, 100% certain of all how that's necessarily distinguished from other ways of producing these things. Yeah, that's sort of fallen by the wayside by now, even.
So the new Xenon results would be in the low mass range and more
sensitive? Well, it's more, I mean, the detector, so there were some preliminary results just a couple months ago, I guess. And it's the same experiment, same detector, same everything. It's just they're going to have a full run. So it'll just be, they'll beat down the statistics. There's not any new, you know, new technology or anything to make it more sensitive. I think any new detector is going to be a few years before they'd have results.
Okay.